This is a tape on Mr. Eugene H. Collier, who at the present time lives at 1814 Jones Street here in Harlingen, Texas. He is a teacher by profession at this time, having taught for the last 34, 36 years. And at the present time is employed with the Harlingen Independent School Systems. He will relate some of his early childhood days as he lived as a young boy at the XIT ranch, and later moving on to some parts of East Texas. Mr. Eugene Collier.
Collier, you were born originally in
Lincoln, Nebraska.
Lincoln, Nebraska. Mm-hmm. And
November the 3rd, 1910.
1910. They may have asked you your age here. 1910. And you lived in Nebraska?
About 6 years.
Before your family came down to Texas.
Yeah, they came to to Hartley, Texas, which wasn't very much of a town in those days. It later grew to be a town. Hartley, Texas was the XIT cattle and railroad company in those days. They always said that we live 32 miles from Hartley. But if anybody asked us where we were from Hartley. If there was a ranch that was farther from the front gate to the ranch house than the one in King's Ranch, it was XIT Ranch, because we had to go 32 miles to town. I remember back in those days, once every 30 days, we got our freight delivered. Train didn't come anywhere near us at that time. It did later, but at that time there wasn't a train anywhere close to our particular part of the ranch. And once a month we'd get our groceries delivered and our freight, which came from mail order houses. We got our groceries the same way people in the rural areas get their dry goods and things from Sears and Roebuck. We ordered our groceries from Sears and Roebuck. They came and a barrel of flour, box of prunes or dried apples, sacks of sugar and coffee, not ground, not even parched, just green coffee beans. And they were to be, and our fuel was coal, of course, in that part of the country, in the panhandle of Texas. Of course, some of them used cow chips and out in the country, but we were fortunate enough to have coal, and that was my job when I was a little fellow, breaking up the coal and bringing it in the house, coal scuttle full of coal. I remember one time in particular, I remember it very well, there was something going on around the corral, and my mother was a young lady, early 30s. And she had gone out to see what was taking place, to watch what happened. I was supposed to get the coal in, and I was busy hacking away the big chunks of coal to get it small enough to put in the container to carry it in, put it in the coal bin, and my father said, "Let that go, we've got to go to town." The first time I ever remember riding in an automobile, what happened? Your mother's broken her arm. She had been on this, had climbed up on the gate to watch them with the stock that they were working with, and something had happened inside that caused her to fall off the gate. She broke her arm. There we were, 32 miles from a doctor. Well, in those days, that was just an everyday affair, you know. Today, it would be a calamity. So, he called a neighbor who lived 7 miles away. That was a close neighbor. And the only, it must have been about a 1913 or 14 model. And if I don't remember, but I probably have heard later, a real automobile.
Uh-huh.
And we drove the biggest part of the night across a prairie, 32 miles. Now, it took the bigger part of the night. Of course, I don't know anything except I left there with them in the automobile, and I got there with them in the automobile. Being that age, I slept most of the way. But I remember distinctly that we went and got her arm in the cast, and our splints or whatever, I don't remember exactly at that time, and that made a very lasting impression on me. I have only one or two memories from our stay in the Panhandle of Texas in Hartland County. One was that they always said in that area that they didn't allow a colored man to spend the night. If a colored family or a colored man came into the county, he had to be out of the county, and most of the natives would tell him so. But my father, even though he was a Mississippian by birth, didn't feel that way. And became very unpopular with some of his neighbors because he insisted on them stopping by the house and having dinner with him, and he'd give them some water or whatever they happened to need. I'm pretty sure things have changed by now. And another vivid memory I have of that, well, in those days, all of the tractors used in the farming of the those days, they didn't have high gear. They had maize and kaffa corn and federita and wheat. And the farming was done with steam tractors. I know you've seen them in the pictures, right. But you've probably never seen one operate because they're all now are so old that they are collector's items. And I remember very distinctly a bulldog that I had when I was about 5, 6, 7 years of age, and part of my time in those years was spent going through the fields where they were gather up the grain in shocks. They put it in a little Indian teepee in shocks, and then came along later with a threshing machine and threshed it. And it was my job and the dogs to catch all the field mice that ran out of those shocks. And another thing I remember is when the grain was gathered, it always they would take it to a central place in the on the ranch, one big hammer mill, I believe they called it, where they ground up the grain for the corn and whatever for the cows. And I had been promised week after week that when time came to have the grain ground, then I could go.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, I looked forward to it and for over a long period of time. But being in the fall of the year and in the Panhandle of Texas, the weather's a little uncertain. I might say it is certain. It's pretty apt to be bad. And so it just happened that about the time they got the seven wagons loaded with grain, carried to the mill, what we called in that area a blue norther came up. You could see the cloud coming and the sky was blue in the north. So my father and mother decided the weather was too bad for me to make the trip, and I couldn't go. Of course, that upset my apple cart, and I tuned up. After the wagons had left, my mother decided that to take my mind off my troubles, she'd send me to the mailbox. It must have been a couple of hundred yards maybe from the house to where there was a so-called road. There were two ruts that went by. She said, go get the mail, Yankee. So I took off to the mailbox. And in the pasture was 400 or 500 calves, and they didn't know but what I might feed them, so they followed me down there, and I got lost in this bunch of calves. Got the bright idea, I don't know where, must have been my own, I was by myself, that all I had to do was just take off down the road behind those wagons, then I could make the trip to the hammer mill anyway. So I took off. I got down the road about, oh, I guess it was quite a few miles, 3 or 4 miles. I was a little fellow, 6, 7 years old, and came to the first neighbor's house. And the lady came out and stopped me and told me that my mother said to me to hurry home. Well, I turned around and started back. But after I got down the road a couple hundred yards, I decided that wasn't necessary. All I had to do was go through the fence, go around behind this lady's house, and come back into the road on the other side. Mm-hmm. We're getting plenty of youngsters, so I did that. And the next memory I have was of arriving at this place. I knew where it was. I could, everything was flat in that country anyway, and you could see for miles and miles. But as I got there and started toward the mill, going by the barn, I met my father, and he was in a hurry to go to the phone in the house. And he put me in a stable where they kept horses and hooked the gate, the door, and he went to answer the phone, and it was my mother. The phone ran on the top wire on a 3-strand barbed wire fence in those days, and he didn't have a phone line. He just had a barbed wire on the fence. And if the fence got down, well, your phone was down. So she had told him that I'd run away from home and she couldn't find me, and she was worried. And he assured her that he knew where I was and he would take care of the situation, which he did. He took a rein off of a bridle and he gave me the thrashing of my young wife, and I'll never forget it. That's one of my outstanding recollections for that period of time. After we left the Panhandle, we spent about a month with my father's people in Mississippi. He had come from Mississippi, a small town between Jackson and Meridian on the highway, Flora, Mississippi. We spent about a month there with his people, and between there and going to East Texas Trinity County. And I remember very distinctly that having lived in this county in Texas, Hartley County, where the colored man wasn't allowed to spend the night, and having spent the rest of my young life in Lincoln, Nebraska, where one color was just like another one, and as far as we knew, well, I didn't know what a colored man was. I didn't know what a Negro was. I'd seen him. I saw the man selling candy and chewing gum on the train. He was colored, but Porter was colored. But so I, of course, called all of the old colored people who worked around the house for my grandfather. I called them all Mr. Jones and Mrs. Jones, and it just tickled them to death because nobody in that time, that, remember, this is 55 years ago approximately, nobody at that time in the South referred to any black man as Mr. or any black woman as Mrs. And boy, if you don't think I got royal treatment out of those colored people. But my father was always felt the same way that I did. I guess that's one reason I'm in the valley today.
Your father was, mentioned earlier in our conversations today, that he was foreman of the
XIT branch, yes. I wouldn't say that it would be all of what's the XIT now, but he was foreman of a big area. There were many big areas at the time. Yes, he came there. He played semi-pro ball and Clifton, Arizona. He worked for the Arizona Copper Company, and then they sent him from there to Lincoln. And at Lincoln, the Cushman Motors was the same people, same company, and he played there for them and remained there. Semi-pro ball in those days, you worked and you played ball about three days a week. He worked as a machinist for Cushman Motors, which is still in existence, I think. They make Cushman Motors today. Mm-hmm. Of course, that was before my time, really. I was rather small. All I know of that is what he has told me. Mm-hmm. And then after he had an accident, got a piece of steel in his eye. It didn't amount to much, but it did interfere with his ball playing, and he decided to quit the machinist work. And these same people were interested in this XIT ranch, and mm-hmm. for that reason he was sent there. Actually, that's where they say they farmed him out at the XIT ranch. Then he decided to leave there. There was a big fire up there, so even we actually left there. My father, in helping the other fellows fight the fire in a corral,
uh-huh.
five men came by and wanted to brand some stock, and my mother was at the ranch house, and there were a couple of workmen there, but nobody else was there to give them permission or not give them permission. So they just told her what they wanted to do, and she assured them that part she knew that was all right. They went out and fixed their fire and all, and heated the irons to brand the strays they had picked up. You didn't have fences around the ranches in those days. They had what's called a drift fence.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be to the south of the area that you were interested in. And after a big blizzard, all you had to do was go to the drift fence to stop because it would push them that way.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't go over it unless it snowed and drifted and froze and they could walk over it. That was the only time you'd lose them. My father was away, and he got back later in the afternoon. Somebody ran in from the corral and said the corral is on fire. Well, in the floor, the deck that is in the yard around the barns where the horses and all the animals were, hay and chaff had gathered over a period of no telling how many years, and where these fellows had planted the stock, they had kicked it out, stomped it out, they called it, gone off and left it. Mm-hmm. But it had caught underneath the surface and just smoldered there for hours. And when anybody realized there was a fire, the corrals were going.
Mm-hmm.
And they lifted water in tubs out of tanks that had been dug in the ground. They, tried to put it out,
mm-hmm.
but they lost the whole thing. Long haystack, though, it was high as, about as high as that ledge, a little higher there, and
mm-hmm.
that's about as long as that wing.
Mm-hmm.
That's where they kept the hay.
Well,
lo and behold, burned for days, and that was the reason that he decided he had better take a rest and better leave that work. And he left that work and went in business later then in East Texas.
Mm-hmm.
He was in general mercantile business. And
were there any number of ranch hands in this particular area?
Yes. Yes. We had 15 or 20,
15, 20.
Men in a bunkhouse. They were, most of them were, most of them were transients. We'd have a man for a while, and we had some that were there all the time, and then some that would drop by. We had Anglos, Latin Americans up that far. They were working mm-hmm. up that far then. They followed that kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
No colored people in that county. But yes, we had about 24 there.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing I remember there is the storm cellar in that part of the country. Everybody has a storm cellar, And I also remember the dust. It was before the Dust Bowl days, of course, by many years, but we still had our dust.
Uh-huh.
And it was impossible to keep in a window like this, if it were no tighter than this, there'd be a little dust forming right here. It'd be just blow through the cracks in a house. It looked like it was absolutely sealed.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't seem to keep out that terrible dust. I remember that very distinctly. That and the prairie flowers, and I remember those as a child. A little shorter season even in the panhandle than we have here, and with that all the flowers tried to blossom at once. And when you have bluebonnets up in the central part of Texas up there, you have prairie flowers, and they are beautiful. So that was as a child, I remember.
Is there any particular type of excitement as far as this ranch hands go, the usual
yes.
rowdy bunch?
I believe the outstanding thing that I remember was not about one of the ranch hands, but about the man who drove the freight wagon.
Uh-huh.
He was a man with a handlebar mustache and with white hair, a slender, not an ounce of fat on him, but once a month, old man Sack Camel, he was called Sack Camel, I don't know where he got the nickname Sack Camel. But I thought that there was nobody like him. I was just a child, 6 or 7 years of age, but he could do anything in the world with a whip, or a laird rope, and a mm-hmm. gun, a rifle. He was the only man that I have ever seen. I don't remember whether I've seen a trick shot artist or not, but he could take a little rifle that he had, a .32-20. I haven't ever seen one since. But he'd take that 3220 and put matches up in a wooden fence, wooden wall, like that, and strike the match. Well, that rifle was just a plain, open iron sight, and I didn't think that anybody else in the world could do that, and I haven't seen anybody do it since either. He could also take a long black snake whip, they call it, and just cut a piece of paper or a magazine or a flower or a leaf off of a tree or anything like that, that I thought was, that was a highlight. Just see that wagon coming. He was going to stay all night because he had to. He had to at least spend a night with us because it was a long way to the next stop.
And he worked for the XIT?
Yes. He brought the stuff out from a central headquarters. I assume I was just a child. I wouldn't.
Did all of
them except what I was told about most of that?
Did all the men wear sidearms or?
Yeah.
That time they still did.
My father didn't ordinarily, but he did it on occasion. That is, depending on where he was going, what he was going to do. But most of them had sidearms. Yes, and most of them had a rifle and something like a 30-30 Winchester. It was a popular rifle in a scabbard on his saddle, just like the movies.
And
deer, antelope, prairie chickens and prairie dogs, and jackrabbits were plentiful, horned owls and rattlesnakes. That was about the extent of the livestock in that area, but they were quite plentiful. And I was back in that area later, like 30 years after that, and I think I saw 3 antelope. No prairie chickens. Prairie dogs were still fairly plentiful 30 years later, but I understand now that they're practically gone from that area.
What was the usual type of social event that this man looked forward to?
Was going to town Saturday? On Saturday night, yes, if they got an opportunity to go. Most of the time it was meeting at some central place for a Saturday night dance, I assume. But most of the rest of their time was spent pitching horseshoes, or they pitched silver dollars a lot in those days. They'd dig a hole like we fix the washers, you know, and stand a two-man team, and they would then pitch those. Usually there was, time to time in the season, there was some kind of a rodeo. Dumas, Texas wasn't too terribly far, and they had a big rodeo in those days. Dumas was the town that had the wooden courthouse longer than anybody I can remember. They'd usually go there for rodeo entertainment, but then on the weekends and times when they weren't too busy, they always was somebody that would bet someone else that he couldn't ride a certain horse, and they always had to go see if he could, and most of the time he couldn't, as I remember. But I spent part of that time overseas where stamp didn't bother us, but I did do remember a little bit of that, and I know that my father's in business, and it was rather rough on him, you know. That was a big item, taking care of the stamps for the sugar or whatever was rationed at that time.
In the time that you have been teaching now, and World War II come about, you did participate in the armed services as
a man. I went in the Marine Corps in 1943, and May the 25th, I believe,
1943. You continued then teaching afterwards.
Yeah, I came back. I got out of the service on the 20th of August, 1946, and went to coaching at Newton High School in Newton County in Deep East Texas, right next to the Louisiana border. And I was there for 13 years as coach and high school principal. After I quit coaching, was high school principal for the rest of that time.
At Newton. Mm-hmm. That goes back to the days of World War II, and education then at that time is, of course, was a lot different than what it is today.
Right.
What do you recall about regular classroom procedure or kids and their attitudes at that time as compared to today?
Well, there was, since I began my schooling, in, which would have been about 1917 or 18, I guess it would have been 1918.
Mm-hmm.
I remember very distinctly that my teachers, as I came through school, pretty well ran their schoolroom, and I remember that when I was a student and when I first began teaching, the students all, when the bell rang, they all lined up in a line by the, at the door to the appropriate room of the school, and when the next bell rang, they marched in and stood by their chairs and their desk until the teacher gave them permission to be seated, and they sat down. It's not exactly like that in my classes today. I remember that when I then first went to teaching, I was right in the Depression, in 33, the fall of 33. A job was hard to come by, and the first school that I took, the first job that I got a chance at after applying in 5 or 6 places, was a job in the country in Trinity County, back in the same county. Right now, I guess Lake Livingston almost covers up the school site where I was. I taught for $75 a month. Took $37.50 of it in a check that I could cash.
Mm-hmm.
And the other $37.50 in county scrip, they call it, which meant it was a hot check on the county that they couldn't cash, but the bank would take it at a 10% discount.
Mm-hmm.
So if you see, I was actually taking, working for $75 a month with a 5% discount over the whole 75, or 10% on half of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't last but 3 months at that. Somebody died in the county, and he had a $135 a month job, and that was a big job in those days, so I made the change right in the middle of the year. My first year, a lot of people always told me, you know, when I started teaching, well, you ought to teach 2 or 3 years in the same school. I just lasted 3 months in the first
one
because I couldn't stand it, man. $75 was little enough, but after you discounted 5%, you were worse off. But I did make the change then, and I was principal of a little consolidated rural school for the last half of that school year, or last two-thirds of it. Schools in those days lasted any 7, 8, or 9 months, depending on how much money you had.
Mm-hmm.
This was before Gilmer Aiken, you know, and salaries were very, very poor. I remember that later on then, well, in that same year, to show you how prices go, I bought a new Plymouth for $900.
At that time?
Yeah, new Plymouth, a brand new car. It wasn't anything like a new car today. It didn't have nearly as much on it and all, but it cost $900. One that I imagine, I'm just guessing, cost you $3,800 to $4,200 to $4,400 now.
What year was that?
That was 1933. Uh-huh. Well, I guess maybe it was on in the 1934.
Mm-hmm.
It was 1933-34 school year.
Mm-hmm.
Then I don't remember the exact figure, but I think it was $998.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that was, it was less than $1,000 for a new car.
Well, this
prices run
for that time, $900 or $1,000 is quite a bit of money.
It was a lot of money. Yes, sir. Certainly was. Actually, it came nearer being your year's salary then than buying an automobile with now, because you take the ordinary teacher's salary now, you could buy two automobiles with it, couldn't you?
Mm-hmm. Sure
could. You couldn't have done that if you were working for $75 a month for 9 months. But I remember price-wise how things turned out. in Woodville, Tyler County. This is north of Houston now on highway, I believe it's 59, north of, let's see, no, it's north of Beaumont, isn't it? Yes, north of Beaumont. I went over there in 1942 and 43 to a job. And in those days, you bargained for the amount of money you were going to get. And I was over at Huntsville. My people were still living in Huntsville. And I was there. I don't remember where. I guess I was going to summer school. Anyway, I was living there and in the summertime. And the superintendent came by to see me about coaching football at Woodville, county seat of Tyler County. And the Kirby High School was the name of their high school. And he said, I tell you what I'll do. I'll give you $2,000 to coach football this year, and I'll give your wife $1,000. That will make it $3,000 between you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was a considerable lift from where I started. So I said, I thought I was going to be drafted. At that time, they were drafting people my age, and I was 32. And they still hadn't dropped back to the 27, or 26 or 7, or whatever they dropped mm-hmm. back to later. And I had already had my examination, and I mm-hmm. was ready to go. And I told him, I said, tell you what you do. You give me $1,500, and my wife $1,500, and we'll come.
Mm-hmm.
I thought maybe if I'd got drafted, she'd have
still have that.
Well, it didn't. I got to work out the whole year before I had to go in. And then when I came back out of the service, I'd have to look at some figures somewhere to find out. But things that this was before I went to service. When I came back out of the service, things had perked up considerably.
Mm-hmm.
Teachers were still rather scarce, though. So many people had gone into industry and had remained there and around that a job was pretty easy to get, as I remember, especially a coaching job. So many men had gone into the service mm-hmm. and left. So I went back then to Newton High School as coaches. We said, well, I'll go stay there. I coached at 50, from 46 to 50, and then the principal left, and I had resigned from the coaching position. The war didn't leave me in too good a shape to coach mm-hmm. football, and I decided I'd had it with the football, and so I was principal then until 1958 and 59 school year. Then I went to Holiday Zeta. I went to Holiday Zeta to get out of the classroom, and the week before school started, my wife and I both were going to teach there in high school at Holiday Zeta. The junior high principal resigned. The superintendent had 7 men in the system who wanted it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the only reason I got it, I didn't want it. See, mm-hmm. I was off fishing in the Gulf, and the superintendent called my wife and said, say, I've got a principalship open. I wonder if your husband would be interested in it. The reason he chose me was because he didn't want to pick either one of the 7 men in the system already. He knew he'd make them mad. So I got back from a fishing trip. I had a job. She said, I'll accept for him. So I wanted to get out of administration then because mm-hmm. I felt like I could. The daughter was out of school, and I had been wanting to get out a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And So I stayed in 1 year longer than I planned to, mm-hmm. but I've been quite happy here. I've been here 13 years now, and mm-hmm. this is, I've been 2 places 13 years.
13 years.
And since I've been teaching, I've stayed in the same job 13 years in 2 different schools, and I believe this has been the most pleasant part of this, of its salary, part of it's a nice working right. situation.
Uh-huh. You mentioned, when we talked earlier, the watch that
just council.
Is there not room for it? Yes. But Mac, if you want to erase some of that other, you can go back and stick it on there.
No, there's plenty of room here. We got lots of room here. And
on the other side.
On the other side. Squatch Citizens Council was sort of an organization of some sort here. To
yeah, in the, throughout the South, after the Ku Klux Klan became so unpopular, there were a lot of people, white, Anglo-Saxon Protestants, mm-hmm. who formed in the South what they call the Citizens Council, and only a white man could belong to it. And actually, their reason, as I gathered, I never went to a meeting, but I gathered, I did go to a meeting one time that was called, and it was called for another reason. And when they got there, it seems that they were making an appointment with the people who were meeting that night. They just called it a community meeting. They made an appointment with them to let's all meet at a certain time. They were going to form. This man was coming from another town, and they were going to form the White Citizens Council. Mm-hmm. They formed it, and I didn't attend the first meeting, and later on I was invited to attend and to join, and I didn't go and turn them down as gracefully as I knew how. But in those days, the line was drawn in that area. You were either with us or you were against us. Mm-hmm. So I had to be rather unpopular with some of my better friends in that area. And then I happened to run into Mr. Broyles. And when I was changing from Newton High School to Hulday Zeta, that year I happened to be on the campus when he was up. He was at that time, I believe, an assistant superintendent here before he was acting superintendent. He came up through around the Sam Houston campus, and I ran into him and Marshall Story up there. And Marshall was the superintendent down at Port Isabel at that time. We talked, and that was all. And a year later, I got a telephone call from him. It said the Latin would be, job would be available at junior high in a year. Mm-hmm. But if wife and I come down and I teach math in the seventh grade for a year, then the Latin job would open, and that was 13 years ago, and it did, and we did, and here we are.
Yeah. Well, then this White Citizens Council was something similar along the lines of the Ku Klux Klan.
Except it wasn't as secret or as secretive and all as the Ku Klux Klan, and I guess it wasn't as rabid as the Ku Klux Klan, but it definitely was pro-Wallace, pro-white man, as opposed to any other color as I looked at it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was strictly a segregationist group. You knew of it, didn't you?
Right.
You knew it existed. And I suppose it just died on the vine when finally the American public waked up to the fact that integration was the best thing for everybody concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess they did. That's the way it looked now, and I suppose it just swiveled up on the vine because there was too much opposition. They stood for about the same thing that Wallace stood for.
Or shoot up the place downtown, you said.
Well, now, I didn't get in on that. I was a country boy, and boy, I was a country boy. I was rather young, and I don't know. I never did see a person shot in our group.
Mm-hmm.
I heard talk from come in from town about one man shot another one in town in a saloon. That was the days of open saloons before Prohibition. But of course, I wasn't in a position at 6 or 7 years of age to know, except that I could hear.
Uh-huh.
Hear him talk about.
And after the, what was it, 2 or 3 years at the XIT ranch? Is that how long you all stayed over there?
I was there 4 years.
4 years?
4 years. Rather small.
Uh-huh.
y'all moved then after Mississippi, they came back to East Texas.
Yeah, and, Trinity County. And that's where my mother had taught school, and that's where my maternal grandparents were at that time.
Did you go to school there in Trinity County?
Yes, I went for 11 years. It started, my birthday came the 3rd of November, so I didn't get to go the year that just before, you see. So I had to wait till I was 7. All right, when I was 7, I was nearly 8 when school started. So I was in the first grade when they, it seemed to me like I was in the first grade when World War One was over, November the 11th. And it would be 1918, wouldn't it? Well, I had just started school that fall. But I was, by the time November the 11th, the time Armistice Day came, I was already 8 years old. So I was actually nearly a year behind in school. My father was on the school board there. About, he got elected about the second year that we were there. And I just started school. And I remember that on the day that the First World War was over, I was a little tyke in the first grade. And school was dismissed. All of the whistles blew and school was dismissed. And we marched in groups, a distance of about as far as from here to Vernon, I imagine. All the students in the, all grades marched uptown and were dismissed. And my father had a store there on the corner. And so he reached out and got me as I went by. I remember the end of World War One. I just do. But prior to the Armistice Day, 11th of November, all I remember was hearing talk about the war. My father didn't go, but was just ready to go. He was just about to be drafted. He was a man with a family and 2 children at that time. There were 4 of us later, but 2 at that time, and it looked like he was going, and then the war was over, so he missed that one.
Later, you went on and continued your education, or
I went from there.
Started teaching school.
Yes, I went from there to Huntsville to school when I finished at Groveton, and. Groveton was the county seat of Trinity County, and was in its heyday was a pretty nice little town of some 4,000, county seat with a big sawmill. But of course, in those days, they cut the timber clean, and when they cut out, they cut out. So we left though before they left there. My father moved. There were 3 girls and me, and we went to Huntsville. He moved to Huntsville and went in the grocery business there. And bought the grocery store just off the campus, kind of community grocery, in order to send the 4 of us to school. And all 4 of us went to school, and all 4 of us made school teachers. And we're all 4 teaching now, I believe. Yes, we're all 4 teaching. Well, I believe one's a librarian, but she taught for years and finally decided to get out of the classroom. I came from a long line of teachers. My grandfather, my maternal grandfather was a teacher. My mother was a teacher, and all 4 of us are teachers, and one of the sisters married a man who is a teacher, so we, and assistant principal of French High School, so we, there's a lot of school teachers in our family.
That's good. You all been, you have been teaching now 34 years.
34 years, yes. Over a period of 40 years, I've taught about 34. I started in
1933.
Fall of 33 is not yet 40. It was 39. But 39 is fall.
Your schooling then took place during the era of the Depression.
Yes, exactly.
The era of the Depression.
That's right. I went from 29 to 33 was my to get my bachelor's. Right.
I imagine that's the time when all the stamps are being used.
Oh yeah.
Purchase
items. Yes. Well, now the stamp, I don't remember much about the stamp in that day. I remember the stamp in the Second World War, but it was during the NRA, and yes, it was, I don't remember. I was just a teenage kid, All I remember that was scarce was money during the Depression. I remember the stamps now. I don't remember stamps during the Depression of any kind.
Right, it was during World War II. Yeah,
World War II, you had to have a stamp for gasoline, for tires, for sugar. Yes. And I remember in the First World War, there were times when we wouldn't be able to have what we were accustomed to eating for breakfast, for instance, because of a shortage of flour or sugar. I remember seeing my father and mother using brown sugar that they happened to have because they had run out of sugar stamps.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe she had made a cake or something with the last sugar, and they would have to either use honey or syrup or something sweet other than just granulated sugar because you just didn't have any more. Mm-hmm. When it ran out, you had to wait till the next time, or the next month, so you could buy whatever it was. Mm-hmm. I remember that in the First World War, and then in the Second World War, of course, it became quite acute. I didn't know much about that. Keep our schools, our churches, and our communities just as a white man. That's the way I may be a little that way myself, but that's the way I interpreted it there. Or he wouldn't have been called a white citizens council.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty good.
And maybe they just call themselves the citizens council, and I call them the white citizens council. Because I'm a little on the dark side of the get out in the sun. Some of us Irish are a little on the dark side.
When did that XIT ranch break up?
I'm a history major, and I'm not, but I don't know. I remember my father mentioning it, you know, talking about it and about them dividing it up. And how much of it was intact when I lived on it as a 6-year-old, as compared with how much there had been. I'd have to go to a book to find that out, because it didn't mean a whole lot to me then. There were a lot of other things that were a lot bigger in my life than that. But I think the majority of their dividing it up came well after we were there. Because,
mm-hmm.
see, it would have been 55 years ago,
mm-hmm.
when I left there.
Mm-hmm. And you were only there about 4 years.
About 4 years, from very small up to just about time to go to school. Well, today I would go to school. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have been going to school. Mm-hmm. But if I'd gone there, it'd have been 7 miles, and my aunt taught mm-hmm. school 7 miles away.
What was the nearest neighbors in that particular area?
7 miles.
7 miles.
I could see the house.
You could see the house.
I could see the house because the level around just like this. Just mm-hmm. that level. I guess, except in the panhandle of Texas, I suppose the only thing is the Canadian River and Palo Duro Canyon that isn't flat. You know? And everything real flat. Everything looks like it does in a mountainous country like that. I could just walk over to that mountain, but you can't make it in 3 days. Well, that was the way it was then. We could see, I could see the nearest house and the nearest people. And part of the time there was a family who lived in a house about 4 miles, 3 or 4 miles from mm-hmm. us. But it would just, from time to time, somebody lived there and somebody wouldn't right. live there. And
I've still quite a bit of distance as far as neighbors go.
Yes, it is, but it's still
traveling going on.
Part of the country is still like that.
And wagon was the usual motor traffic.
That's all. You take, for instance, when I was 5 and 6 years of age, I only rode in an automobile one time, and that was when my mother broke her arm.
Mm-hmm.
That was the only automobile I'd been in. Everywhere else we had gone, we'd traveled on the train, or in a wagon. Mm-hmm. Our father on horseback.
The train had already, the railroad had already come through that area at
yeah.
the time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Hardly had a railroad.
Well, with so much distance spread out here as far as one house to another, neighbors, and then 30 miles from town,
mm-hmm.
What was the usual day routine for 6-year-olds then, brothers and sisters, and what occupied the time?
Well, you had to improvise. Yes, we practiced doing the same things that we saw our father and the other men do. If it wasn't anything but hitch two horned toads to a shoebox, we had to have a wagon and horses, and we had I had a dog, and I chased field mice and with a dog, and my sister and I played and fought. My sister and I, we had only one sister at that time, played and fought. And I was always both of being a school teacher. I can remember being read to a great deal, and I can remember in the evenings when I wasn't necessarily supposed to be listening to my mother and father. My mother and father took turns reading novels, or reading whatever they were reading to each other.
Right.
And many of the stories that I learned, like Tarzan of the Apes or something like that, Little Shepherd of Kingdom Come, I didn't read them, I heard them read, you know. And I'd sit up as long as they'd let me. No radio, no TV, if you can imagine such a thing. So I saw my first picture show, I was about six, and I was at church then. Saw it at church. It was something that the preacher had brought in.
Is that the silent type?
Yes, that's the silent type, because I was in high school, the first talking picture that I ever saw. Mm-hmm. I believe the first talking picture I ever saw was Edward Everett Horton and the Hottentot, or Lilac Time, I don't remember which, but one of those two pictures was first.
It was
neither of them. Well, one of them was full talkie, I believe, and the other was talkie. Partial. Uh-huh. Some music in it. Uh-huh. But prior to that, you used to have a silent movie in there, mm-hmm. and a man playing a piano, or sometimes some right. theater's organ, you know. But oh, I saw my first movie, and I guess I was must have been at least a junior or maybe a senior in high school.
Mm-hmm.
When the talkies came in.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Yeah, and I guess the first radio I ever heard was at the State Fair in Dallas. I don't remember the year, but I remember we got an old Atwater Cannon in 1924. That was a big radio, like this big, that sit on a table with a big horn. On top of it like that. Old Atwater Kent.
Mm-hmm.
I remember it took four batteries and one A, two B's and a C. And you had to operate three dials in order to tune the station in. I had heard a radio set at the Dallas Fair. I don't know, I'm just guessing around 1919 or 20. Somewhere along there. I was 9, 10 years old when we lived in East Texas. My father had carried some animals or something to the state fair, and I got to go with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I swung around that radio room where the radios were at the fair while I was in the marvelous. And when I got back home, I awarded my father, and I don't guess he was ever going to buy a radio, but we went to a neighbor's house to hear a prize fight.
Uh-huh.
And I was so young, I don't remember whether it was Dempsey Tooney or which one of the fights it was. I believe it was prior to that. But anyway, it was around 1923 or 24,
mm-hmm.
and he got interested in bought us a radio,
mm-hmm.
our first radio. Same year we got our first automobile, 1923 or 4, mm-hmm. along there. I remember very distinctly. Mm-hmm. The lady wants to see. We've been here nearly an hour.
Right. Were there any particular ghost stories in your young days that you recall superstitions of any sorts?
Lots of superstitions, I'm sure. I don't know that I was ever... I guess I missed most of that. My father had always been a skeptic as far as ghosts were concerned, and I guess he convinced me at an early age. I did pass the cemetery walking to school when I was a young fella, and I'm sure that I walked a little faster if it were late in the evening or at night when I passed the cemetery. Walked a little faster and whistled a little louder, I imagine. But I never was aware of the fact that I was afraid of ghosts because I don't know, somebody had convinced me that I need not be afraid of them, and I wasn't worried particularly. I'm sure there were plenty of superstitions, and still are, but I don't recognize it as superstitions.